My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions.
The dossier, I would say it's a solid source and some one of those sources.
Most of his articles written from sources that are from papers captured in 1991, so 12-year-old papers.
What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence. I would call my colleagues' attention to the fine paper that the United Kingdom distributed yesterday.
I would say that there's a lot of very intelligent people in Britain today, but I don't think that intelligence is actually transferring itself into the government's presentation for a case for war on Iraq.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, February 10th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. An emergency NATO meeting today called by Turkey seeking approval of a plan to protect Turkey in the event of an American-led attack on Iraq ended today in continued deadlock. France, Germany, Belgium, and later Russia insisted more diplomacy is needed before readying for war. France and Germany's veto deepened divisions in the NATO alliance over Iraq, with American Ambassador Nicholas Burns saying the move had plunged NATO into crisis. Turkey invoked the alliance's mutual defense treaty, calling unscheduled consultations. In Washington, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said the United States and the 16 other countries in the alliance would go ahead with planning, quote, outside of NATO if necessary, unquote. While the Bush administration dismissed Iraqi overtures to cooperate with UN weapons inspectors today and stepped up its rhetorical campaign against Saddam Hussein with accusations he would use civilians to shield his troops. Denouncing Saddam as the true enemy of Iraq's people, President Bush said the Iraqi leader regards them as human shields, entirely expendable when their suffering serves his purpose. In stark contrast to Bush's assessment of Saddam Hussein, Chief Weapons Inspectors Hans Blick and Mohammed al-Bardari emerged from talks over the weekend saying there had been a change of heart from Baghdad. Peace Watch correspondent Jeremy Scahill is in the Iraqi capital where he files this report.
The Chief UN Weapons Inspectors Hans Blix and Mohammed al-Baradei left Baghdad today, saying they had found no smoking gun. They called on the Iraqi government to continue its cooperation with the weapons inspections process and, in fact, to increase that cooperation. The inspectors said that Iraq was showing a greater willingness to cooperate with the inspections regime, but they said that Baghdad had not delivered the kind of dramatic breakthrough that could effectively halt the march toward war, if, in fact, anything could. Now, there are just days to go before the next defining moment in this crisis is in front of the world, and that is on February 14th, when Hans Blix and Mohammed al-Baradei return to a UN Security Council that sees an increasing threat from Washington of a unilateral attack on Iraq if the UN does not give the United States UN authorization to do it under the UN flag. The inspectors leave Iraq today with a number of issues that they say are still outstanding, one of them being the interviews of Iraqi scientists by the UN weapons inspectors. They have been calling on Baghdad to allow the scientists to be interviewed outside of the presence of an Iraqi government official. Many Iraqi scientists have said that they do not want to do that, and they have, in fact, requested Iraqi officials to sit in on the meetings and to also make sure that the meetings are tape recorded. Well, over the last several days, several Iraqi scientists have been interviewed outside of the presence of Iraqi government officials. The weapons inspectors hailed this as a good step forward, but said they wanted to see more of it. Another major issue that is outstanding is the issue of the United Nations weapons inspectors' request that they be allowed to send aerial spy aircraft over Iraq to do surveillance of sites around the country. The Iraqis have said that because of the regular bombing by the United States and Britain in these so-called no-fly zones, that Iraq cannot ensure the safety of the aircraft and that they fear some kind of an incident would be sparked by the United States to lead to a massive bombing of Iraq. Now, Hans Blix expressed what I think many could see as cautious optimism on the situation. He said that over the 2 days here, he saw a beginning to take disarmament issues more seriously on the part of Baghdad. He also said that the recent Iraqi moves, and this was echoed by Mohammed al-Baradei, were what he called a change of heart on the part of the Iraqis. And they pointed to these private interviews, as well as the fact that Iraq has just handed over to the inspectors a number of documents that are detailing what Iraq says is its destruction of its stocks of anthrax and VX nerve agents. But the inspectors say that while these are welcome, that the documents are not records of the alleged destruction of the agents, but that they are new documents explaining how Iraq had gone about the process of destroying these agents. Now, both Hans Blix and Mohammed Al-Baradei said that they are continuing to advocate for the continuation of the inspections as an alternative to a military attack against Iraq. They said that this is what the world is calling for. And Hans Blix himself said that he had seen a large banner when he arrived in Baghdad that called for UN inspections, not a U.S. invasion. Now, Mohammed Al-Baradei, for his part, said he believed that the inspections here would continue as long as Iraq made what he called quick progress in its level of cooperation. Baradei saying the ball is very much in Iraq's court. As long as we're negotiating good progress, I think the Security Council, in my opinion, will continue to support the inspections process. That from Mohammed Al-Baradei. Now, after the last round of meetings with the Iraqi officials last night, Mohammed Al-Baradei and Hans Blix addressed reporters inside the heavily fortified UN compound in the Canal Hotel on the outskirts of Baghdad. At the press conference last night, I had the opportunity to ask Hans Blix about these so-called no-fly zones.
Question. One is that Hans von Spanik, the former head of the UN Humanitarian Office here in Baghdad, has said that there is no mandate whatsoever at the UN for the no-fly zones and calls them illegal. So I'm asking, are you going to, as part of the negotiations, call for an end to the irregular bombing by British and American warplanes?
No, we have nothing to do with the no-fly zone. There's nothing in the resolutions that are setting up my organization to discuss and to deal with the no-fly zones. The legal views are divided on that, so we do not enter that. The resolution does not make any reference to it, although it was well known that they existed at the time. So we think that we are entitled to do what the resolutions say.
George W. Bush, as well as Colin Powell and Donald Rumsfeld, have said that inspections are not the issue, that Saddam Hussein's regime is the issue. Do these kinds of statements undermine your ability to complete your work here?
I don't think so. I think results will prove. If we have results, it will count. And if we don't, well, that will undercut us.
Can I ask you to answer my question that I asked you in the press conference? And that is, will you ask for the U.S. and Britain to stop bombing Iraq in the no-fly zones as a measure of good faith in this process with Iraq?
No, we have nothing to do with the no-fly zones. We are operating exclusively under the resolutions that give us a mandate. And that's for the U.S. and the rest of the Security Council, not to us.
Are they hindering your work, though, Dr. Blix, the no-fly zones?
No, we are asking the Iraqis to give us the permission, rather not permission, but at any rate to give a green light and positive attitude.
Jackie Suen and I then headed back to the Iraqi Ministry of Information, where General Amir Saadi, the special advisor to Saddam Hussein, was responding to Hans Blix and Al-Baradei. And we continued pressing on this issue of the U-2 overflights, and we asked General Amir Saadi to respond to the statements given to us by Hans Blix.
Hans Blix said tonight that UNMAVIC has nothing to do with the no-fly zones. And he also said that he would not directly ask for a halt to the U.S. and British bombings. Is your position, given what you said the other night about Gulf of Tonkin and another incident, is your position that you would not be willing to allow the U-2 flights unless there's a ceasing of the bombing?
I said that there's a new way of looking at this problem. In connection with a whole range of three other, let's call them for the time being, surveillance platforms. One American, one Russian, and one French. In that context, we could see a possibility, because then such incident cannot be so easily arranged or engineered, as I mentioned. And this is being carefully considered, seriously, and we promised to come up with a solution before Friday.
You might be willing to allow these flights even with the regular bombing of the U.S. and British planes. Is that, you're saying you're open to that possibility?
Doesn't that imply that? I mean, I have answered your question. So
That was Dr. Amir Saadi, the special advisor to the Iraqi president, Saddam Hussein, and the liaison from the Iraqi side with the weapons inspectors here in Baghdad. So the word from the Iraqi government is that they now appear poised to allow the surveillance planes to fly over Iraq, despite what Baghdad sees as a major risk of sparking a war, another Gulf of Tonkin, as the Iraqis put it. Clearly, Baghdad hopes that this is going to win them points and embolden the growing calls globally for a continuation of the inspections process and not a U.S. invasion.
Jeremy Scahill reporting from Iraq. Since that interview this morning, Iraq approved U-2 surveillance flights, a key demand of inspectors searching for banned weapons, but the Bush administration said it was too little too late. When Secretary of State Colin Powell made his presentation before the UN Security Council last week attempting to make the case for military intervention in Iraq, he claimed that his multimedia display was well-researched and documented.
My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence. I would call my colleagues' attention to the fine paper that the United Kingdom distributed yesterday, which describes in exquisite detail Iraqi deception activities.
Unfortunately, that British dossier that Powell cited wasn't quite as solid as he claimed. It turns out that large portions of it were plagiarized from several sources, including a chunk from a thesis by Ibrahim al-Murshidi, a postgraduate student in California whose essay was published in the scholarly journal The Middle East Review. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Glenn Rangwala, the editor of Middle East Review.
Well, I found that pages 6 to 16 of a 19-page report and the substantive heart of the report itself on Iraq's supposed infrastructure to conceal its weapons of mass destruction was lifted from online sources. Most of it was taken from an article written by a postgraduate student in California who had written, as part of his thesis, an article on Iraq's security and intelligence structures. Most of his article is written from sources that are from papers captured in 1991, so 12-year-old papers. And this was being presented by the British government as a dossier on Iraq's current program to conceal its weapons. So that was a direct falsehood in the British government's approach.
And what was your reaction to that?
My first reaction was to some extent shock, but also, to be honest, I wasn't altogether surprised. The British government put out a report in September last year on Iraq's weapons. Now, that report was shown largely to be inaccurate. It made detailed claims about Iraq's facilities within the country. And since that date, weapons inspectors from the United Nations have visited those sites, and they've visited them repeatedly. And they found that very little to substantiate the government's claims about those sites. So it's already been shown, as far as I can tell, that Britain has weak intelligence facilities within Iraq at the moment, if it has any, and it has been unable to find out substantive information about Iraq's facilities in this regard. So when you don't have those sorts of sources in the country, all you can do is rely upon open sources to make a case about Iraq's concealment activities, and that's why they lifted the article, I believe, from the online sources.
Peace Watch also reached Ibrahim al-Murshidi, who's now a research associate at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies, and asked for his response.
Well, the dossier, I would say it's a solid source and some one of the sources. I mean, it's just the question was how they took it. That's questionable. It's, just, I think it was a case of intellectual theft or of academic violations. But nevertheless, the information I provided about the Iraqi intelligence structure was as up-to-date as I can make it possible. And I based it on thorough research, backed it up with sources, citations, and myself, I've studied the Iraqi security apparatus for close to 4 years now. I've read their captured intelligence documents that were brought to the U.S. and so forth. So I don't want to over-exaggerate my expertise, but I've probably studied the Iraqi intelligence agencies as close as anybody could possibly in the U.S. So
yes,
basically, I'd like to advocate that my source is as solid as I could have made it.
Mm-hmm. But when was this report prepared? Wasn't it actually 12 years ago?
No, the documents, those captured Iraqi intelligence documents, were 12 years old.
They were 12 years old.
Yes, but the information I provided in that article was as of September 2002. And even though those documents are 12 years old, the intelligence structure is still intact. There hasn't been major changes in the way they operate or their chain of command.
But Dr. Glenn Rangwala disagrees.
Ibrahim al-Marashi doesn't have, as far as I can tell, direct sources within Iraq at present. The articles, in his article that was published last September, his primary references were to 1991 material and to other open sources. He hasn't been able to, say, interview people involved directly in Iraq's concealment activities, and he hasn't been back to Iraq to actually directly investigate these sources himself. So he's not in a position to tell if there have been substantive changes to Iraq's facilities over the past 12 years. And I would add that I think, from my experience of Iraq, there have been substantive changes in Iraq's basic infrastructure. And I'm thinking more about its political infrastructure and its civil infrastructure over the past 12 years. And for that reason, I would suspect, though I have no proof of this, I would suspect that Iraq's security and intelligence structures as well have undergone major substantive revisions over the past 12 years. The country has changed enormously in that period. And therefore, I would say that the information presented by the British government is very unlikely to be true. In some cases, we know it's untrue.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't just take from al-Marashi's article. They took from two other online articles that were in a British intelligence magazine. And what they've done at one point is actually taken the wrong section from one of the articles and placed it as supposedly describing another institution. So they've miscopied the information and presented it as accurate information about one particular service, the military security service.
Completely taken out of context, in other
completely
words.
Taken out of context and completely incoherent, because what they've done is they've had one paragraph from one author saying this organization was established in 1992, which is correct, and they had the rest of the section on that particular organization going on about how it moved its headquarters in 1990. So that's because they took it from a different section of a different article about a different organization. And what they've done is they've just completely confused two different, substantively different organizations in that regard.
And in your opinion, what does it say about the strength of the case for war if the British and American governments aren't able to come up with fresh, new intelligence data, but are rather recycling old information?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we've seen this whole justification for the possibility of a war being made on the basis of intelligence information. That's clear from the three British dossiers that have been released on Iraq. It's clear from Powell's presentation. Now, what this episode showed was that the British government really doesn't have that sort of intelligence on the ground about Iraq today. Either that or the intelligence is actually being ignored because it's not saying what the British government wants it to say. And there's no reason to believe that the US have got any substantively different sources, because many of the similar problems that appeared in the British dossier have also appeared with the American presentation of events in Powell's statement. So if that's the case, and the intelligence sources that we've been presented are not really as accurate as Powell and Blair and Bush have claimed, then the whole justification for war looks entirely more shaky.
Hmm. How is this scandal, so to speak, playing in Britain?
It's playing very today. The most senior member of the House of Commons, the British legislature, was thrown out of the House of Commons for raising this issue repeatedly to try and press the government about why they had effectively lied to their own members of parliament and why they'd presented information that was substantively inaccurate. So that gives you an understanding of the scale of the outrage it has caused amongst even members of the Prime Minister's own party.
Is it going to have a backlash beyond that, do you think, for Tony Blair?
I think certainly so. I think Tony Blair's further claims about what he can tell from British intelligence sources will all be treated from now on with a great deal of scepticism, and rightly so. If the claims about British intelligence inside Iraq are no longer seen to be viable, then the whole justification for war looks more shaky, and that therefore they will have to either try something different in justifying a war, or they will have to change tack completely.
It's starting to sound like that term British intelligence is a bit of an oxymoron.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I would say that there's a lot of very intelligent people in Britain today, but I don't think that intelligence is actually transferring itself into the government's presentation for a case for war on Iraq.
Dr. Glenn Ranwala, editor of Middle East Review. Fallout from Secretary Powell's presentation last week to the UN Security Council continues to build. Peace Watch spoke with a childhood friend of Secretary Powell's who has carefully followed his career. Alambe Brach, chair of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition and host of Pacifica Station WBAI's Africa Kaleidoscope, says that he is not surprised by Powell's performance before the UN and characterized Powell as one who goes along with the party line.
One of the things about Colin Powell, his people came from Jamaica. Mine came from Barbados. At that time, there was a lot of immigration from Caribbean, where people were settling both in the private houses and also in the tenements. And ironically, he lived in the tenement side, 952 Kelly Street. I lived at 751 Kelly Street. So we knew each other pretty well. Mm-hmm. Pretty well.
What was he like back then?
Well, he was a person that was very much to himself. He was high strung. He was color conscious, meaning that, you know, because of his light skin complexion, he didn't have too much respect for people who was darker than himself, like myself.
Well, why do you say that?
Because we had a confrontation over it one time. And one of the reasons I studied him, you know, long before anybody was talking about Colin Powell, I had been talking to, you know, as these people reflect about their growing up, I brought him up, you know, before I even knew he was in Korea. And it just so happens that when he started his career, I started to follow him. And, I can see it by a number of things. When Barbara Walters, in an interview, asked him about his racial background, he gave a description as the Tiger Woods, you know.
Well, what do you recall from that?
Well, he says that, you know, when she talked about him being an African-American, he didn't add it on about every other kind of ethnicity he could in order to defer from that. And he makes statements regarding that he's not too dark-skinned. And I think that it's been played out if you study his role in the military. First of all, if you look at his career, coming out of the military and then going over to be a White House fellow in the administration of Richard Nixon, you get an idea that this person is on the road to strict conservatism by that, at least in racial matters. And he was not the person so much engaged in civil rights, although he benefited by the civil rights movement. He went to Morris High School. He went there because it was free. And he had benefited by it. He didn't gain any kind of conscience about civil rights matters until recently, when it becomes important because you become a political figure.
Now, the young Colin Powell that you knew, were there any indications that his politics would be as hawkish as they have come to be?
In fact, he's more hawkish than all of us in a certain way because he's the only one of the cabinet that has a real military history.
Did you watch the address the other day? What were your thoughts at the time?
Well, I thought that, hey, here's a guy who's not speaking to, you know, Pacifica people. He's speaking to the nation, and he's speaking to a lot of people around the world, and he's trying to speak to the people of the United Nations. Because most people realize that, you know, Colin Powell, like all the rest of them, they have ways of doing these things that they can read anything somebody gives them. It was interesting to note that they kept saying how much he had done it to put this speech together and how important a document it was. And I don't know if you know the latest coming out of Channel 4 in England, that the speech was really
plagiarized.
You know?
Yes.
So I'm saying that by that alone, to present that as, you know, some original documentation and something that is totally that clearly would show why the United States should go to war, which it did not. I think that you have to realize that he is an excellent presenter.
Alambe, you knew Colin Powell as a youth. He is someone who is widely regarded as an individual that is trustworthy, and many analysts and observers have noted that that's why he was selected to present this this very critical case before the UN. What can you say about Colin Powell and his trustworthiness?
You know, I'm very on the point, because right there, if you if I sat up there in front of you and said that I did this, and I'm telling the whole world I did this, then you find later on that Alambe didn't even, you know, when he sat up there and told the whole world that he did, this was supposed to be something that according to Condoleezza Rice, and she was promoting how he thought this all out. In other words, trying to pump it up as it was original from the United States. You would say that there goes your whole argument about being trustworthy. And the fact is that you will see that he is a person that he is a creature of the system of some of the most right-wing fellows.
Do you think, let's just assume or pretend that you would have an opportunity to have an audience with Secretary of State Colin Powell. What would you say to him?
Well, I said, I've studied your career, and I think that it's interesting that you now see that you have some interest in Africa, but I think the interest conflict with the majority of interests of the African people. I would say that you knew what you became the architect of the Panama invasion, and the 7,000 people were killed because the United States government decided they wanted to capture Manuel Noriega. I think that what you did to the people in El Chorrillo and some of the other neighborhoods where people were slaughtered and buried, it was a crime against humanity. I would say that your support for what the United States did in Grenada was also a crime against humanity. And I'm saying that your record shows clearly that you fought in Korea. You know, you were actually supportive of the war in Vietnam. And so all of the areas, even though you were stationed in Germany, but most of your fighting has been done against people of color.
So you would say, finally, Mr. Powell.
If you wanted to show that you had some principle, you should resign.
Alambe, thank you very much. This has been an enlightening and engaging and informative discussion, and we thank you for being available and providing your unique perspective on Secretary of State Colin Powell.
Thank you very much, Ryan.
Alambe Bratch, childhood friend of U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, stuck in between the Iraqi crisis on one side and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict on the other, Jordan is concerned about the consequences a war in Iraq could have on its fragile stability. Along with a possible influx of Iraqi refugees on its soil, its major concern is the development of the Palestinian Intifada. Jordan's Foreign Minister Marwan Muashur met with Ariel Sharon's Chief of Cabinet Dov Weinglass yesterday in Amman. Raphael Kraft reports from the Jordanian capital.
Most of the region's leaders would like to see Yasser Arafat replaced. That's what Ephraim Alevi, the head of Israeli National Security Council, told the annual Munich Conference on Security Policy yesterday. While Ariel Sharon has announced he would soon meet with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, Jordan's Foreign Minister Marwan Muasher received Ariel Sharon's Chief of Cabinet Dov Weinglass yesterday in Amman. Jamil Nimri is a journalist at Amman newspaper Al Arab Al Youm.
Officially, Jordan recognized Yasser Arafat as a legitimate leader of the Palestinians, but maybe Jordan, they would like to see a different performance of the Palestinian leadership, especially in the issue of the reforms. And they may see, but they never say in public, that Arafat does not do this in a good way, the reforms. They may see better some other leaders like Abu Mazen, but they're afraid that this condition of the Israelis is just a smoke mask not to go forward in the peace process.
With the war in Iraq looming, Jordanians fear violence in the occupied territories would rise. The Jordanian government is concerned Ariel Sharon could use the war in Iraq as an opportunity to push the Palestinian population out of the West Bank into neighboring Jordan. Already, more than half of Jordan's population is Palestinian. Jordan is the only country in the Arab world that has given nationality to Palestinian refugees. 3 days ago, the Israeli ambassador to Jordan issued a statement in the Jordanian press that insisted Palestinians would not be forced out of the West Bank. Mustafa Amarne is the director of the Center for Strategic Studies at the University of Jordan.
I think the issue of transfer is very serious, and the Jordanians take this issue extremely seriously. And they've notified both the Americans and the Israelis about this. The Americans responded in September, October. They made statements and they informed the Israelis that this is a major Jordanian concern. And in this day and age would reflect a collapse of human civilization. And I don't think the world will put up with Israeli transfer. There will be no repeat of 1948, 67. And of course, we saw what happened in Jenin and no Palestinians wanted to leave.
Anti-Israeli sentiment is strong in Jordan and is fueled by Sharon's methods to deal with the ongoing intifada in the Palestinian-occupied territories. Saddam Hussein on Tel Aviv was among the slogans in a demonstration against the war in Iraq held in Amman 10 days ago by a coalition of political parties ranging from leftist to Islamic parties. The Jordanian government is aware a war in Iraq could be a factor of instability in the kingdom. Before the Israeli elections, Jordan has had contacts with the Labour and Meretz Israeli political parties. As Jamil Nimri explains, the Jordanian government would welcome a dovish Labour Party joining Sharon's unity government.
They would like to see the Labour Party in the coalition. Maybe they think that would break the extremism in the government. They don't believe that this will make different policy for Sharon to go really to the peace process. But at least they will not see an escalation in the Israeli policy with the Labour Party and the government. But they have no illusion about the peace process in this phase, yeah, at least.
Officially, Marwan Muasher held talks with Israeli envoys amidst increased efforts to swiftly implement a Middle East roadmap within the framework of the quartet, including the European Union, the United Nations, the United States and Russia. A peace plan for finding a just and comprehensive solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict, and eventually arrive at the establishment of an independent Palestinian state by mid-2005. This roadmap will be determined after a possible US-led war on Iraq. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Raphael Kraft in Amman, Jordan.
We'll be back in a moment.